Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 257, and we're going to talk about the ultimate first aid kit for van life. This is a big project that I am not qualified for, but you know how it is. We're also going to talk about multi-tools, which one to pick, and maybe you should have more than one. A product review of a very interesting thing to stop bleeding, and a tale from the road involving a neighbor and a moose, which is often not a bad combination. Hey, folks, welcome back. Thank you very much for listening once again. I'm happy to be here with you. I have been working on this podcast for almost a year. What is the proper stuff to have in a first aid kit if you're going to head out there on the road and be self-reliant? I mean, you could be in a remote location and not be near any kind of emergency resources, or maybe you don't have cell phone signal or whatever. So you have to be more self-sufficient, and that would require you to be more ready to render and receive first aid. Let's face it, if you go out and buy a first aid kit, you're going to get a box or a bag filled with Band-Aids, a few little ibuprofen tablets, maybe some tape, and ooh, some plastic scissors. I mean, they just don't come with much stuff. And to get any of the ones that are actually useful, you have to spend hundreds of dollars. And so I thought, well, what if we just worked on this and figured out what we actually need? What are the problems we're going to encounter, and what are the things we should bring with us in order to meet those problems? And the first thing we need is an understanding of what first aid is. It's first aid. It's aid that comes first. It is not meant to cure. It is not meant to do anything other than get somebody stable so that they can proceed to the next phase of whatever course their treatment is. If it's a headache, your first aid may be to take some ibuprofen, and that might be the end of it. But some other things, first aid is merely stopping the bleeding so you don't bleed out before you can get to professional help. They're very different things. And so I focused on that. This first aid kit is for emergencies, and it is meant to stabilize someone such that they can receive professional medical attention. Now, obviously, I am not a doctor. I am not a trained anything, really. The only certification I think I've ever had was to dispense propane, and that is long expired. So take everything I say as a friendly person offering you some ideas, because that's all this is. Anything I say that sounds interesting, you should verify with a medical professional. That said, I did check all this stuff as well as I could, and I tried to use reliable medical sources. What do you think is the very first thing that should go into your first aid kit? And I'm going to give you a big hint. It doesn't go in your kit. It goes in you. Yes, folks, that's right. It's training. You can have all the tools in the world, but if you don't know how to use them, they're not much good to you. I mean, you can give me all the tools in the world to build a rocket ship, and I might be able to build something, but I'll bet that rocket won't fly. And I'll have a resource recommendation for a good source later in the podcast. But you should know that there is the regular first aid training that you can get that's just general all-purpose first aid training. And then there's a specialized first aid training for the wilderness that deals more with things that you will encounter in the wilderness, such as animals and falls and alkaloid poisonings and things like that. And it's probably the one that best fits van life. It's the one that's going to understand that you're isolated, because most of first aid is, you know, call 911. I mean, that's the biggest part of all first aid. If you don't have that option, you need to go to a next step, and the wilderness first aid training will get you there. Second thing you want to get, and this can go in your first aid kit, is an emergency number list. Now, these numbers obviously vary by country. I will only give you the U.S. ones here because I don't know where you are, but there are probably similar numbers in the country that you're in. The first is poison control. U.S. Poison Control is 1-800-222-1222. You can call that from anywhere in the U.S. Somebody will answer the phone and give you information about poisons. Of course, there is general emergency 911. That is the number here in the U.S. That should work just about everywhere from every device that can make a phone call. In other countries, it might be 999. It depends. Find out. And then another line to put on here. No, seriously, you should put this on here because it's just important to know about. And that is the mental health support line, suicide hotline, whatever you want to call it. It's when you're having a mental health issue. It does not have to be suicide. It can be anything. If you're just feeling very sad or confused and you just need someone to talk to, there are people who will talk to you anonymously, non-judgmentally, and without any cost. And the U.S. has set up a system called 988, and literally write these down on a card or on the lid of your first aid kit so you don't have to think, because that's the thing. When you are in a situation where you need to render first aid, thinking is hard. There's a lot of stuff going on, and just having a number written down can be one less little thing to think about. And do that for whatever country you're in and add whatever numbers you think apply. And it's not a bad idea to do the research and find out where your nearest emergency room is, where your nearest hospital is, that kind of stuff, and also add that on there. And we already have a pretty good first aid kit. But let's get into the stuff. And yes, this will be long. I'm going to skip the news for this podcast because it's going to be so long. First thing you need is a bag or a case. I'm not going to recommend a specific one necessarily. It should be something colorful. It should be something portable. It should be stored somewhere where you can just grab it and go. I think soft-sided ones are better than hard plastic ones. You can argue that the hard plastic ones protect the things better, but the soft-sided one is more flexible. It fits in more places. It's easier to carry, etc., etc. If it's a bright color with reflective stuff on it, that's all the better. If it's really big and you're going to be in a severe wilderness area, you may want to make it a backpack so it's easier to carry, but pick one. Pick any of them. It doesn't have to be expensive. It just has to be something that you know what it is, it's well labeled, and that somebody else could find if you sent them to your van to say, hey, get the first aid kit. Okay, now onto the stuff to put into the bag. And I should mention, this entire list with links to the subjects on Amazon is available in the show notes. And if you can't find it, send me a note at jeff@builtogo.com and I'll send you a link or a PDF or whatever you need. But yes, all this stuff is linked. So if I say something that doesn't make any sense, feel free to go to the show notes, look at the link and say, oh, that's what it is. Or if you disagree, please let me know, because I want this to kind of be an ongoing conversation. If you think I have stuff on here that doesn't make sense or I'm missing stuff, I think that's great. Okay, so what do we put in the bag? Yeah, okay, I tricked you. Now we're going to talk about things not to put in the bag, because there's a lot of first aid kit things that people think are essential that science no longer supports. First of those is hydrogen peroxide. Yeah, hydrogen peroxide is fun. You put it on a wound and it foams. It looks like a little volcano. It's like, ooh, that's... Yeah, it's not actually that great at disinfecting, and it actually does cause some tissue damage. So people don't use that anymore in medical things. So you can leave the hydrogen peroxide out. Another thing to leave out is snake bite kits. The current thinking on snake bite is that you don't do anything to it. You don't suck out the poison. You don't cut the little X's there. There's no tourniquets. You don't do any of that stuff. You can cover the wound with a gauze, but what you're going to do in every single case of snake bite is take that person to medical attention as soon as you possibly can. That is your mission. There's no treatment of the person. The treatment is to move that person to professional medical attention. Now, the good news is, at least in the U.S., obviously other countries have different snakes and different issues, is that deadly snake bites are very, very rare. Rattlesnakes, the one we hear about so often, only 1% of their bites contain venom. They don't want to waste their venom on you. They are typically biting you as a warning, and they think, and properly, that if they just bite you without injecting any venom, that'll be enough of a warning. So, yes, you should do all the things to avoid getting bit by a rattlesnake. That's no fun at all. An infection is always a risk, but it's not the death sentence the movies make it out to be. and all that stuff you've seen about spitting and sucking and cutting and all that, forget all of that. Your only mission is to get that person to help where they will receive antivenin if it's required. And the last thing is syrup of ipecac. This is an old school thing, but it's basically this liquid you drink that makes you vomit instantly. And the thinking was that if you swallowed something bad, you should get it out, right? And so you swallow the stuff and vomit it up and you're good. Well, the new thinking from what I'm seeing is that forced vomiting is almost never indicated, and it can actually be more harmful. And so the current thing, and if someone out there is a trained medical professional and disagrees with me on this, please let me know, is to not induce vomiting, is to treat it a different way, and of course, get them to medical attention. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the list. Okay, enough teasing. Let's actually get to the stuff we're going to put in the bag. First thing is a stop the bleed kit. This is an entire kit. Its only purpose is to stop traumatic bleeding. If someone gets a deep gash or actually loses a digit or a limb or something like that, this is the kit you want. And that's all it does is stop the bleeding. That's what it's for, is to prevent someone from bleeding out. They're not all that expensive. They come in packets all by themselves. They're even small enough to keep in your pockets in most cases. I'm not going to talk more about them because what you really need is training on how to use these things. So if you do get the Stop the Bleed kit, and I think you do want to do that, do the training. Understand what you're doing, because you can save a life with this one little thing that can cost $10. Very important thing. Number two is a pressure dressing, also known as an Israeli bandage, and it maintains pressure over a bleeding wound. This is if you have a chest wound, this is the kind of dressing you would put on that to stop bleeding there. After that, hemostatic gauze, also known as quick clot. This is a type of bandage that has a powder in it that will help clots. If you're in the woods and you have to take somebody out and you're going to have a period of time where they're traveling, this is the kind of thing that's going to keep them stable. Next on the list is blister tape, sometimes called moleskin. This is to help prevent blisters and to help cover blisters. Carefully read the directions once again. And that is high on this list, not because that is a life or death thing, because it is such a common thing and it can be debilitating. If you hike into the woods 8 miles and you get this huge blister, well, then you have to hike back 8 miles with that blister. And this stuff can help you get past that. Next is burn cream. Burn cream for minor burns. This is more of a comfort thing than anything. And there's some debate over whether you should use it or not. But I included it here because comfort is important. And you can use any minor burn cream. Don't worry about the antibiotic stuff. It's really not about that. It's more about comfort and providing a protective layer. And you can also use this for sunburn too. The sunburn stuff tends to be stuff that disappears, but you know, we're living in the woods here. We don't really care about aesthetics as much. So I wouldn't even bother with the sunburn stuff. I would just stick with regular burn cream. Next is medical paper or silicone tape. This is a kind of tape that is hypoallergenic. I mean, you can put it on your skin. It sticks well. It's easy to take off. And you would use that to put the gauze on. And then you want another kind of tape, like a heavy-duty cloth or waterproof tape, to hold bigger things on. For example, you might put gauze on a wound, use the paper tape to hold it onto the skin, and then maybe tape up a plastic wrapper around that to keep rain off of it or whatever, and you'd use the heavier-duty tape for that. You'll find a need for it. Just make sure you have it. Next is cotton swabs, you know, like Q-tips, although the medical ones are better, the ones that are made out of wood. It's a wooden stick with a cotton swab. Those have a whole bunch of uses, such as applying said ointments, and you can actually use them as fire starters too. So hey, why not have them do two things? Next is heavy duty feminine pads. Now these would not be for menstrual use, but hey, if you needed them for that, that's fine too. No, these would be mostly to absorb bleeding and other bodily fluids as necessary. It's a good thing to have, and depending on your situation, you might apply that directly to the wound. Again, that's part of the training thing. A flat style instant cold pack. You snap it or break it or shake it up or something and it gets really cold. A flat style one is pretty small. They have a shelf life of a few years. I would throw one in there just for comfort's sake. Comfort is kind of important. You know, it's not just all about surviving. There's mental health involved, and comfort can help ease mental health challenges. So I would recommend throwing a couple of those in. Sterile gauze pads, of course, you're going to have a whole bunch of sterile gauze pads, you know, of all different sizes. And that's the one thing that all first aid kits come with. And then an irrigation syringe. Because of the association with drug use, etc., the ones you can buy tend to have a tip that's curved and you can't attach a needle to it. It doesn't matter. You can use any one you have. The needle ones are fine, but the point is that this will give a way to wash out wounds or teeth or whatever, eyes even, whatever you need to wash out. This is a great way to do it. Next, some antiseptic wipes like benzalkonium or chlorhexidine, not alcohol. So you would use these for wound wipes. And alcohol also works, but it has two problems. One is that it hurts like hell, and the other is that it can actually damage tissue a little bit. I wouldn't be shy about using an alcohol wipe, but this stuff's better. Okay, then some hydrocolloid bandages. So these are like Band-Aids. I know that's a brand name, but they're Band-Aids, but they're not made out of the same stuff. They're kind of made out of a rubbery stuff, and you put them over a wound, and the wound stays moist. It's a fairly recent thing. I mean, you know, maybe 20 years recent, and it's really good for wounds that you don't want to air out. You really want to protect them, so get some of those too. And then, of course, you get the normal Band-Aid adhesive bandages as well, because there's always uses for those. A whistle. Yeah, that seems strange, right? Why would you have a whistle in a first aid kit? Well, there's a lot of reasons. For one thing, you can use it to whistle, and if there's somebody who is semi-conscious, you can see if they hear the whistle, and that can be useful. Also, it's a great way to call for attention. So if you're treating somebody and you need more help, you can use that whistle to try to call for more help. Very cheap, very small. Link in the show notes again, but you want one of the little loud ones. A disposable thermometer. I went back and forth on this a lot. A thermometer is good because you want to see if somebody has a fever or not. And the digital thermometers are the standard these days. That's what folks use, but they have batteries in them. And I didn't want to put something with batteries in it in the first aid kit because batteries wear out, they corrode, etc. So I looked at the put them on your forehead thermometers, and they're terribly inaccurate. So I found these new ones. They're nano dot thermometers, and they come in packs, and they're single use. You take it and you put it under your tongue, and then you pull it out and you read it, and you basically read the dots, and it tells you the temperature. These have a good shelf life. They don't need anything. They just work. The only trick is that the reading only lasts about a minute. So after you take the reading, you should either write it down or take a picture of it, because you won't be able to go back and look at the thermometer and see what it said. Next is a scalpel or a razor blade or something like that. You just never know that when you might need to cut something. Scalpels are easy, and they sell disposable ones on Amazon. You know, that's not a bad way to go. A stainless steel sewing needle. There are times when a needle is useful for popping blisters, which you should only do under very specific conditions. Generally, you don't want to pop a blister, or removing splinters or things like that. The reason you want a stainless steel needle, and we're just talking about a sewing needle here, it's nothing fancy, is that you can sterilize it by holding it over a flame. Next, a first aid guide. Yeah, you want a book, you know, and you should read the book before. At this point, when it's in your first aid kit, it should only be for reference, like if there was a picture or, you know, you wanted to make sure you were doing something right, you should have already read the book. But the one I'm going to recommend is Mayo's Wilderness First Aid book. It's the right topic by the right people, and I think that's a good choice. It's not very expensive. So go ahead and get one of those and throw it in the first aid kit. And this is a little strange, but I do think it's true. A small compass. I found a great little compass carabiner on Amazon. It's only a couple bucks, and it's fairly accurate. I mean, it just has to point north. The reason you want this is in case you are in a wilderness situation and you're trying to figure out where landmarks are or whatever to call in help. Knowing where north is, if you're talking to a responder, can be very useful. There's a mountain. Where's the mountain? It's over there. No, you want to say it's to the north or northwest of where I am. Magnetic north, of course. Little, tiny, inexpensive thing to throw in there. A tick remover tool, also known as a tick key. I would call this optional because they do it the proper way, which is grabbing by the head so you don't squeeze on it and get all that stuff in you. They're easy to use. However, it's an extra thing that you may not need. I mean, it depends on what kind of camping you're doing. If you're heading into a heavily tick-infested area, sure, tick removal tool makes sense. But if you're camping somewhere that, you know, just doesn't have any ticks, well, it might be a waste. A CPR mask, which is basically a one-way valve. This is a rescue breathing tool. It prevents you from having to put your lips on someone else's lips, which, you know, you may not want to do, depends on who it is and the circumstances. And this is a little bit more protection. However, it does require training. So this would require CPR training. So you can throw one in the kit, but if you're going to go that far, you really should take the next step and learn how to use the thing. Some sterile eye wash, which is just saline solution. You're going to want a bottle of saline in there in some form. And one of the uses would be for eye wash. That would be a very common use. Some trauma shears. Don't get excited about getting the foldable ones or anything like that. Just get a good, solid, sturdy pair of trauma shears. They're not that expensive. You don't really want to get the plastic ones with like the razor blades. You want decent trauma shears. You know, next time you run into a paramedic, look what they have and you'll notice that they're just regular old trauma shears. Now, here's the danger with trauma shears. These things are good for cutting all kinds of things like chicken bones and blister packs and all that stuff. I'm going to recommend you actually get two trauma shears. You put one in the first aid kit and you put one in your junk drawer, and then you don't use the one in your first aid kit and lose it, because that would be bad. Some tweezers. In fact, I recommend you get a set of tweezers that has really fine tip and really flat tip, and that's great for ticks or splinters or whatever. Definitely want to have that. Not very expensive. Acetaminophen, also known as paracetamol, Tylenol is the brand name. It is another pain reliever. In fact, I'm going to recommend three different pain relievers to have in there. You should have ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and naproxen sodium, which is sold as Aleve in the U.S. They're all slightly different and better at certain things, and some people react differently to each, so you might as well have all three. It's not very expensive. Some activated charcoal. You can buy activated charcoal in all kinds of forms, capsules and pills, something like that. This is something you would use if there was a suspected poisoning. Just suspected. That's all you need. You don't need to verify poisoning, whatever. This stuff cannot hurt you. It's absolutely fine to just take it. So if you're ever in doubt, just take it. Did you eat some berries over there? You don't feel good? Take some of this. That's what that's for. And then seek medical attention as well. So zinc oxide diaper cream. This stuff is magic. I mean, you can use this for all kinds of things. You can even put it on your nose in the summer, and it acts as a sun protectant. It's obviously good for, you know, diaper issues, but it's also good for chafing on all different forms of your body and rashes, insect bites. It's better than calamine lotion. Calamine lotion is almost the same stuff, but it's liquid and it smells weird. Not that zinc oxide smells great, but, you know, a zinc oxide cream like Desitin or one of those has so many uses. It's very inexpensive. It keeps well. And I definitely think it should be in there. Some meclizine or dimenhydrinate, it's motion sickness tablets. I like bonine personally. Some people like Dramamine, whatever the heck you like. That stuff can be very, very good to have if somebody's undergoing motion sickness. It does make you sleepy, but it's better to be sleepy than motion sick. Some antacid tablets, because a lot of times heartburn can be very, very severe. I mean, it's not a minor thing. It may not be that dangerous, but it feels dangerous. So Pepcid AC is the one I like, or the generic of that. It's famotidine, and it also has a pH buffer in it, and those two actions work really well for me. I would always have some of those with me. I'd put some in the first aid kit, and I'm going to have some just in my toiletry kit too, because that's good stuff. Some oral rehydration salts. So this is like powdered Pedialyte or something like that. If somebody is out working hard on a hot day and they're sweating profusely, this stuff might help them feel better if they start to get a little woozy. If they are out on a hot day working hard and they stop sweating, well, that's heat stroke rather than heat exhaustion. That's a whole other thing, which you will read about in your first aid guide. Loperamide, which is more commonly known as Imodium, is an anti-diarrheal medicine. It is a good thing to have with a caution. So as somebody who travels a lot, I do travel with this stuff, but I never use it unless I absolutely have to. When would I absolutely have to? Well, if I've got a plane I have to board and I'm having an issue, I might use this. The reason you don't want to use it is that it will prolong your discomfort and illness. that condition is designed to purge your body from something bad, and this stuff prevents that. So you don't want to just take it anytime you're feeling a little, shall we say, loose. You want to very tactically take it only when you do not have ready access to facilities and you have to do something like travel. So good to have, but don't go crazy with it. Hand sanitizer, yeah, okay. Make sure it's at least 60% alcohol. If it has citric acid in it, that's even better because that has some indication of fighting norovirus, although apparently people are fighting about that. Some nitrile gloves, nitrile, not latex. Some people are allergic to latex and it rots. Nitrile is the medical glove of choice. Remember sizes, it comes in different sizes. If you have little hands or big hands, make sure that you accommodate for those. Finger cots, which, let's face it, are little tiny condoms that you can put on your fingers. All kinds of uses for those. Definitely have those. And while we're talking about that, I would also recommend some non-lubricated condoms. Just some plain old Trojan condoms. No lube. Receptacle end, doesn't really matter. These are useful for so many, many... Yeah, I know they're useful for some particular things. And hey, that's not a reason to not have them too. You know, You understand. But for medical things, there's a lot of other reasons, too. You can fill them with ice and make an ice pack. You can fill them with water and have an emergency water bag. You can cover fingers with them or toes. You can do all kinds of stuff. It's a very, very stretchy, impermeable rubber that can be used for a lot of things. So they're a good thing to have. You can actually make tourniquets out of them, too. You can cut them or just twist them and make little ropes out of them. But have them. And then learn how to use them, or vice versa, but do both. Diphenhydramine, also known as Benadryl, is, you know, for allergic reactions, this can be pretty good stuff. You definitely want to read about it and how to use it. Some people are allergic to it, and it's illegal in some countries. In the U.S., it's fine, but apparently, last I heard, in Germany, it was illegal, as well as some Asian countries. So you have to be careful of that. And it will make you sleepy. And some people don't like it. I am not a fan, but if I was reacting badly to a bee sting, for example, even though I'm not allergic to bees, sure, I would take some just as a precaution. Hydrocortisone cream. Yeah, okay, it can help with some stuff. Long-term use is not a great idea, but if you're having some kind of inflammation, hydrocortisone can get it down, but it won't necessarily treat the underlying problem. But it's not a terrible thing to have. Ibuprofen, another pain reliever. That's my go-to. That's what works for me. So absolutely have that on hand. And then loratadine or cetirizine, also known as Claritin and those kind of drugs. These are non-drowsy allergy relief medicines. Honestly, for me, they don't do all that much, but I know for other people, they're super important. They're useful, especially with allergy stuff, but you want to read the label and see what they're useful for, but not a bad thing to have. They can be a little bit expensive, so there's that. A 2-day emergency supply of essential personal meds. So if you are somebody who's on prescriptions like I am, it would be a very good idea to have a 2-day supply of those meds traveling with you. And you won't take them. They're not to take. There's just this 2-day buffer in case you're delayed in travel or you lose your medicine or whatever. Just a good thing to have. Now, getting them is tricky because in the U.S. anyway, insurance companies don't want to give you any more pills than you're supposed to take. A single pill would be a travesty. So one thing you can do, and this is a little bit of a trick, you can go to a pharmacy in the U.S. anyway and say, hey, I lost my drugs. Can you give me an emergency supply? And as long as you can somehow prove that you have a prescription for these drugs and they're not controlled drugs, they will give you a few days worth and then you can just keep those and not use them. Controlled substances is a whole other thing. I should actually do a whole podcast on how to get controlled substances that are prescribed to you when you are on the road, because that's very difficult. But you understand, have an emergency supply of the drugs that you need. Hard candy, or preferably glucose tablets. Why do you have that? Well, this is for people who are experiencing super low blood sugar. Maybe they're diabetic and they over-insulated or whatever. It's a simple little thing to put in there and it can actually help a lot in some circumstances. I've heard that glucose tablets are actually better than like Jolly Ranchers, but I don't think it matters that much. The point is that it's glucose, so not a bad thing to have in there. This one's a little controversial, but I don't think it should be. Naloxone. Naloxone is a nasal spray that instantly overcomes an opioid problem. If somebody has taken heroin or fentanyl or whatever the heck they've taken, and they've OD'd, a single spray of naloxone in their nose will wake them up and cancel out the drug. It's like magic. It really is like magic. Now, they won't be happy that you did this. They'll be quite angry with you, but they won't be dead. So that's a good thing. And naloxone now is available over-the-counter in all 50 U.S. states. Not necessarily cheap, but there are programs where they give it away for free. And though I don't use opioids, unless I had surgery, and then even then I don't want to use them, it's very unlikely I will need naloxone. I will be on the road in all different places with all different people, and the chances of me encountering somebody who needs it is not zero. So I figure, why not just throw it in the case? And last on the list, a permanent marker. Like a Sharpie, although I think there are better ones than Sharpies. I have a link in this document to the Milwaukee industrial markers that I think are better because they will write on basically anything. If you've got like a greasy piece of metal, you can write on it. And the reason you want to have this is so if you were to apply a tourniquet, which you should only do with very specific medical instruction, you would write next to the tourniquet what time you put it on there so people would know. If you were in a situation where you had to leave a victim for some reason, you could write all their pertinent information on them. You know, if you knew their blood type, how long they were there, what condition they had, their name, whatever. It's just a good thing to have because you never know what you're going to have to write down. Whew, that's a lot. And it's going to be a fairly big bag if you buy all that stuff. And I'm not suggesting you run out and buy all that stuff. Those are ideas for things you should have that you should tailor to your situation. You may notice that I didn't mention antibiotic creams like Neosporin and things like that. And almost all the first aid kits come with that. Well, that's because they're not recommended anymore. No, believe it or not, despite the commercials and how common they are, antibiotic creams really aren't that recommended. In fact, petroleum jelly, individual packets of Vaseline, for example, would actually be better. So, you know, I am not a medical person. I'm just somebody who tries to pay attention. You have to form your own opinions on these things. But that was my effort at making a van life first aid kit list. Oh, and how much would that cost? I don't know, but the price range based on what I can figure, depending on how you did it, is between $155 to $230. So let's say up to $250. And of course, there's no upper limit. You can get fancier and fancier and fancier. And after all that, the most important thing I said was that you should get training. And that training should include avoiding needing first aid. Thanks to Denier and David the Ghost, you know who you are, who bought me a gallon of diesel and also, quick side note here, buymeacoffee.com/built2go, that's how you support the show, right? And if you want to have the show continue without ads, you will go to buymeacoffee.com/built2go and buy me a gallon of diesel. Then when there's no ads, everyone's happy, I'm happy, okay? David the Ghost did something different. He went out. Well, he didn't go out. He went on his computer and bought me a very, very nice gift directly related to van life. And I'm not encouraging people to do this, but if you want to, it's totally fine. You know, he sent me a Leatherman signal, which I'm going to talk about in a bit. And I am just so thrilled with this thing. Anyway, more on that later. But a special thank you to David the Ghost. That was super, super kind of you. And thank you to all the people who donate every month. I absolutely appreciate it. Tech Talk. Yeah, I'm skipping news. Tech Talk. So we're going to talk about multi-tools. So I had this incident recently where my Leatherman Wingman, which has been in my pocket for 10 years, suddenly wasn't in my pocket, and I was panicked a bit. And after the appropriate amount of time, I gave up and figured it was lost, and then went out and bought a new Leatherman, and it was stolen by some porch pirate. And then I got the new one, which I decided on the Leatherman wave, and went out to my truck, and oh, wait, yeah, there was my Wingman sitting in the seat. So if you ever want to find something you've lost, just buy a replacement, and it will be there. However, I just have a lot of multi-tools now, and I thought maybe we should address the topic of multi-tools for van life If you're not familiar with multi-tools, they are like grown-up versions of Swiss Army knives. I don't think Swiss Army knives are really all that useful, to be honest. I think the small ones that fit in your pocket on your keychain are just fine. But once you get into the bigger ones with, you know, the saws and the magnifying glasses and the pens and the nuclear reactors and all that kind of stuff they squeeze into there, using any one of those tools is actually quite difficult. Multi-tools, which I think were the modern concept of them, was founded by Tim Leatherman, which is why they're called Leatherman. They're not meant for leatherworking, though you can use them for that, is that they're usable. They're actually useful tools. And I have always found that Leatherman tools have been usable and useful, and I'm a fan, but I'm not afraid to use a Gerber or a Schrade or any of those other brands as well. I did talk about one a couple of weeks ago that was kind of a knockoff Leatherman, but I just want to talk about Leatherman now. I now own a Leatherman Wave, a Wave Plus. They've updated it. I had the original one many years ago, and the Leatherman Signal, and of course my Wingman, which is now in a drawer. Which is the right one of these for van life? Well, first off, they're very expensive, right? They're over $100, $110, $120, $130. The newest one is a $230, I think. The new fancy one, Leatherman Arc, A-R-C, is $250. I mean, it's a really interesting, nice tool, but it starts at $250. You can actually pay more than that for it. Now, to be fair, that fancy Swiss Army knife I was talking about that has every last thing on the planet, it's $412. But, I mean, to me, at this point, you're dealing with something that could get lost. And it's also something that the TSA could take away from you if you leave it in your pocket by accident, which has happened to me, I think, 3 times. So how much money are you willing to invest in this? And the answer is you should invest as much as you can such that you will use the tool and not be afraid of losing it. And that's a tricky balance. Now, for me, I have carried a Leatherman in my pocket since 1995. I always have a Leatherman with me. People will ask me, well, what do you need that for? And often I have a chance to show them as I repair something that's broken for them. Or there was the time I had a kid in the hospital and there was a lot of waiting around, and I took my Leatherman and went into the waiting room where there were a bunch of toys and repaired all the toys with my Leatherman. I mean, I think with my Leatherman now, when I see a problem, my brain goes right to Leatherman rather than, oh, how am I going to fix this? I'm a big fan of these things, and that makes me probably a bad person to talk about them realistically. But which one do you want? Well, you have to ask what you want it for. There's so many different Leatherman tools now that you get to optimize for what you want. So for me, and a lot of people agree with me, the Leatherman Wave Plus is a very good everyday carry tool. Yeah, you fit it in your pocket and you have just about everything you could need. It has little tiny screwdrivers. It has big screwdrivers. It has a saw. It has 2 blades, one of which is rugged. It has a can opener because you never know when you need to open a can. It also has scissors, which, believe it or not, is one of the most common tools I use. And it has locking blades and a really nice pair of pliers. So that is a good one to consider, the Leatherman Wave Plus. But it's like $120. It's not cheap. Also, it's very heavy. And while it does have a clip to put in your pocket, it can still fall out. So anyway, that's everyday carry. That's what I carry with me all the time. When I am at Tiki Bago Land or camping, however, my new carry for that, thanks to David the Ghost, is going to be the Leatherman Signal. This is a slightly different tool. Actually, it's quite a different tool. It's much more modern than the Wave. The Wave now is 25 years old. This is has new thinking in it, and it has a really weird set of tools in it. It has a hammer. Yes, a hammer, like for putting in tent stakes. It has a fire starter. It has a knife sharpener. It has the screwdriver, like we mentioned, but it also has a whistle. Remember we mentioned the whistle? Whistles are a good thing to have. I mean, this is a tool meant to be used while camping. Also, it's interesting, you can take this one apart with a simple Torx bit and like clean it and refurbish it and stuff, whereas most Leatherman tools, you need a security bit to do, so you're not supposed to do that. Anyway, this is a little bit more than the Leatherman Wave. It's fairly simple, but for me, this is a better tool for the actual camping experience. Now, if you're building out a van, I would recommend going higher with something like a Charge, although I don't think they make those anymore, a Surge. There's a whole line of heavy-duty Leatherman tools that would be more useful for building out. Now, like I said, I built out both of the vans that I built out with a wingman, the little tiny Leatherman, relatively little. It wasn't perfect, but it was what I had. Now I was able to get it to work. The bigger ones will be even better. However, you're probably going to wear them in a holster. The bottom line here is these are really good investments to have if you're doing van life. And after you use them for a while, they will become second nature and you will no longer be wondering, how am I going to open this blister pack? Or, oh, I got to use my keys to open this package. Or there's this one branch in the way. If I could just cut that off. On and on and on, you just find all these uses for it, and it kind of opens up horizons. Now, there's a danger there, which is that you should always use the right tool for the job. And honestly, technically, the Leatherman is never the right tool for the job. It's just a tool that could possibly work that you have with you. But there's another maxim that says, the tool that you have with you is the proper tool. You can see there's a balance here that's not perfect. They're meant to be used for emergent things, things that you like just need to do once rather than a whole bunch of repetitive stuff. Leatherman tools have the best warranty you can imagine. Something breaks, they replace it. End of story. No muss, no fuss. And yes, they're expensive, but boy, I really feel lost unless I have one in my pocket. And so I will have a link in the show notes to the whole big broad range of Leatherman tools that you can look at. Watch some YouTube, look and see what you might need. But I'll tell you what, if you are going to give a gift to someone and you want to make them smile, a Leatherman multi-tool might be the best way to do it. It certainly worked for me. Product review. Why didn't he do the Leatherman for the product review? I don't know, because it was a bigger topic than I wanted to do for the product review. That's why. And instead, I have this other weird thing I wanted to talk about, which should have been in the first section because it's an emergency device. This is the Closex Emergency Laceration Closure. And this would be better in a visual medium, but it's what I got. So Closex is spelled C-L-O-Z-E-X. Yes, I will have a link in the show notes. This is a brand new way to close wounds. Okay, so imagine a big wound on someone's leg. It's not going to close on its own. It's bleeding. You've dealt with the bleeding. Now you just want to close it so you can bandage it properly. Well, what would you do? And I can think of three ways to close a wound that work more or less. One is to simply try to tape it closed with like Steri-Strips, which are basically tape to close wounds, or something else. Or you could use super glue, believe it or not. Cyanoacrylate super glue is often used to close wounds. And heck, that might be something you want in the first aid kit too. Or you can do stitches. You know, if you're making a movie about it, well, heck, you're going to have somebody stitch that up with no anesthesia. And if he's a big tough guy, he's just going to take it. Like, oh, that's no big deal. Yeah, you're sticking this needle in my leg, but it doesn't hurt at all. Yeah, all right, it hurts. You know, and heck, if it hurts, it's okay to say, ouch. This, however, this new thing, this Closex thing, doesn't hurt. And it looks like it's more effective. It's really hard to describe, but imagine two pieces of clear, thin plastic tape that are shaped like hands, squared hands with no thumb, and the fingers of the hands interlace. Okay, you got that? So you have interlaced hands. It's a sticker. You put it on the open wound, not the closed wound, the open wound. And then there are tabs on the fingers. And when you pull those tabs, the fingers go towards the opposite hand and grab and close the wound. And then you put them down and the stickers on the tabs hold it in place. That's the best I can do for an audio description. If you click on the link in the show notes, you can actually see how these things work. But wow, folks, you don't even need much training for these. A really big wound could be closed securely with this new fancy Band-Aid, I guess. Now, I've not tried it. I can't really speak intelligently about it. I did do the research I could, and people seem to like them. I think it would be an excellent thing to put in your first aid kit. The only reason I didn't say everyone has to have this in their first aid kit is because they're expensive. I bought a box of them, a whole box. It was $25. That came with two. Yeah, it came with two. So while that's, you know, it's going in my van's first aid kit for sure, that makes them expensive that you're even hesitant to try them. And I think that's too bad. I wish they were a bit cheaper. When you look at them, they're just plastic. Must be a copyright thing or whatever. If you're somebody who's even a little squeamish about this and you don't like the idea of sewing up somebody's wound, for example, this might be a thing to have, and you should at least take a look at it because it's a pretty cool thing. So, link in the show notes. It is the Closex Emergency Laceration Closure, and I think it looks pretty good. Tales from the Road. So when I lived in Utah, I had a neighbor. I know that's shocking, but the second place we lived was a house on Lincoln Street, north of Sugar House. I think it was like 1300 or something like that, if you're familiar with the area. Anyway, it was suburban Salt Lake City. And we lived in the basement, and it was a very affordable apartment that was actually fairly nice. And we had a neighbor upstairs, you know, and the neighbor had a car. I had a motorhome because I'm a freak. And one day the neighbor's car came back to the place, but it was wildly messed up. I mean, he had clearly had an accident. He didn't drive it there, by the way. It was dropped off at our house. He had clearly had an accident, but I could not figure out how this accident happened. You know, if he'd hit a pole or another car, you kind of know what that looks like. But what was wrong with his car was that the hood was smashed in like a cereal bowl, and the windshield was smashed out, and the roof was caved in like a V-shape. So I'm like, did a rock fall on this or whatever? My first thought was, why did you bother bringing this home? Because this thing's totaled. This is never going to drive again. But he thought he could make it drive again. And so I'm looking at all this, and there's all this liquid leaking out of it. And I look kind of like underneath, and I notice that there's this massive hunk of metal hanging from the bottom of the car that's touching the ground. And I'm like, what is that? He's like, oh, that's the engine. I'm like, the engine fell out? And he said, yeah, the engine totally fell out. It's actually sitting underneath the car now. Again, I'm thinking, he's crazy. Why is he trying to fix this? But still, what happened? And so he told me the story. He was driving down I-80 heading into Salt Lake. So that's I-80 West. And if you've driven into Salt Lake City from Wyoming, it's a huge, huge hill that winds around a little bit and it goes kind of in this valley. And it's one of these hills you're going to put in low gear so you don't burn out your brakes and stuff. And it's very, very wide. It's not hard to drive, but it's very dark at night. And he was driving at night and he saw trees in the road. And he didn't have any time to react. There were just suddenly there's trees in the road. And before he could even ask the question, why are there trees in the road? Something hit the car, fell on the hood, through the windshield, onto the roof, and then behind the car. And so he didn't have any choice but to stop. The car was done. The engine had fallen out. And so he managed to get it over to the side just with the momentum after the crash. And he turned the car off, which was basically just a motion with the key. It wasn't running. Got out, had a hard time opening the door, managed to do it. Was very thankful that where the crease in the roof was wasn't where his head was. Tried to shut the door and couldn't. And went out and looked at his vehicle, and there was all this fluid leaking out of it, and it was making all these ticking noises, and yeah. Now, this was before cell phones, so he had to flag someone down for help, but fortunately, that's a fairly well-patrolled area. State police came, helped him out. But he still wasn't exactly sure what had happened. He looked at the car, and there seemed like there might be some fur on there. And he thought, did I hit a deer? But a deer wouldn't do this. I mean, okay, it was a small car. If I remember, it was like an older, like 80s Toyota. Not a huge car, but still, a deer would not have done that much damage. And what was with the trees? You know, when you hit a deer, you see these eyes that glow, and then you hit the deer. He didn't see any of that. There were no glowing eyes. Well, when the state police got there, they asked him what happened, and he was like, I hit something, and then they said, oh, where is it? And he said he didn't know, and the it they were looking for was a moose. He had hit a moose, And they were worried that that moose was injured and running around because moose are very, very dangerous. Now, as it happened, they were able to determine that the moose was not running around, that it was actually off in the bushes to the side of the road and was not likely to come back and bother anybody. So that's one thing. But yeah, this guy hit a moose. And so the reason I tell this story is because if you hit a moose, you are lucky to survive. This is different than hitting a deer. That's dangerous enough. Moose, not only do they weigh a lot more than deer, they're much taller than deer. And even if you're driving with your high beams on, you will not hit their eyes. So you don't get that flashback and say, oh, there's an animal in the road. You see trees in the road, which is their legs. And then it's through your windshield. My neighbor was very, very lucky that the moose landed the way it did, dispersed most of its energy into the hood, and then by the time it went over the roof, it was in the middle, it only got the middle of the roof and didn't crush him. Modern cars, I assume, maybe would it be able to handle this a little better, but maybe not. So yeah, when you're driving in moose country, you've got to have your wits about you, and while putting on your high beams will help you detect deer, it's less effective at helping you to detect moose. You basically don't want to hit a moose. The story I just told was one of the more pleasant ones. Some of them are much, much more gruesome and deadly. A place to visit. One of my favorite places to visit in New England. In fact, when I did my oddnewengland.com website, which you can find on archives.org if you really want to find it, this was a big, big part of the site. And it's called the Curiosity Museum at the Old State House in Hartford, Connecticut. There was this guy named Seward, and he was a senator, and he collected all this crazy stuff and put it in this room. And that was in like in the 1840s. And that collection moved around. But at one point when the Old State House became a museum rather than a political building, they decided to recreate it. And it's up in the attic, and a lot of people visit this place and don't even find it. So when you go there, make sure you ask for it. But it's a true cabinet of curiosities, or a Wunderkammer, but it's a whole room. And it's filled with all kinds of crazy stuff. There's a Hand of Glory in there. That's something worth Googling. There is a Wimshurst machine. That's also worth Googling. There's a crocodile hanging from the ceiling. There's a two-headed cow. There's all these amazing curiosities, and they're curiosities from the point of view of an 18th century person. So some of the things you'd be like, well, all right, that's an alligator or a crocodile. I don't remember which. What's the big deal? Well, back then, if you were living in Connecticut, you had never seen anything like that. And there it was. So an interesting thing about this museum is that it's done in the old traditional style where there are no signs. There's no information. The Hand of Glory is just sitting there. It's just a hand. It's a human hand. It's a mummified human hand without any information on what it is or where it came from. But then when you Google Hand of Glory, you will see the story, and it's supposedly the hand of a robber who has been hanged. Anyway, it's a very cool, very curious place, but they do not have a guide. They don't have any signs. You're going to have to figure all the stuff out for yourself, and I think that's a lot of fun. So I'll have a link in the show notes. This is right in downtown Hartford, Connecticut, the Old State House, not the new one. The whole place is a museum. There's lots to see there. And I'll have a link in the show notes, and it's at a weird URL for some reason, because government, you know. Resource recommendation. Hey, since we were talking about all this first aid stuff, I thought I'd better give you a link to a good online wilderness survival certification. This is a 16-hour course, and you will be certified in wilderness first aid. And I think it would be a great thing for as many people to do as possible, especially if you're like a group leader or you're going to one of these big fests or something. This would be a nice thing to have. And it's done through an organization called survivalmed.org. There's a bunch of different ways you can do it. Some of it is virtual, like online learning, and then some of it's like with Zoom calls and all kinds of stuff. All you need is internet to do it. And I think it's a great idea. Again, another complicated URL, so you'll have to go to the show notes. But it's done by Survival Med. It's called an online wilderness first aid certification. And heck, I mean, that's a professional accreditation, that word there. It's one of those that you could use to get a job or something. I don't know, but it makes you look good no matter what. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 257. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, you can find me at builttogo.com, where you'll find links to Facebook group and Discord server, or by email at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Until next time, remember the words of Mark Twain, who said, "Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." thing, also known as also known as an Jesus.